And in 2019, Jimmy led an extraordinary public campaign against, sounds kind of technical, but it was a bill to make it easy to send Hong Kongers to the mainland for court cases. You know, not something that anybody in Hong Kong wanted. It wasn't just 500,000 people out in the streets. It was 2 million some days. It's like proportionately, it would be as if 90 million people marched on Washington. And I think they just said, we have to destroy it. And Jimmy Lai is public enemy number one. So they came in with a really broad, sweeping, vague national security law. Jimmy was first arrested under that about 6 weeks later. They let him out on bail, but a couple months later, they put him in jail for good. He will certainly be convicted. It's a minimum 10 years in prison, could be life. These charges consist of basically running a newspaper and speaking out for democracy in Hong Kong. It's a reflection of how far Hong Kong has fallen.
When did you first hear the name Jimmy Lai, and what is that story?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. I moved to Hong Kong in 1992, and in probably late 92, it might have been 93, a friend of mine, Larry Zuckerman, who was working for, I guess he was working for the International Herald Tribune then, had profiled Jimmy. And I was a journalist, had just moved down from South Korea, was looking for interesting business people in Hong Kong and beyond. And he said I should go meet this guy who was a retail entrepreneur. He'd started this amazing chain of clothing stores, was a manufacturer, biggest manufacturer of sweaters in Asia, and had been very outspoken in his defense of the pro-democracy movement in Beijing in 1989. So I called up his office, and that's one of the terrific things about Hong Kong is you can have access pretty much to anybody. And I just come from South Korea, and it definitely was not like that there. And his secretary said that Jimmy wanted to invite me over to lunch. That's nice. And she said, he wants to cook for you. Wow. You know, it's pretty rare to get invited to a CEO's house for lunch. And it's the first and last time a CEO ever cooked lunch for me. But went over to his house up in the hills of the Kowloon Hills, overlooking the harbor, the spectacular Hong Kong harbor. And he cooked lunch for me. And we talked for hours about his vision, in particular, his vision for media. And I was, as I said, a newcomer to Hong Kong, but he explained to me why what seemed like a crazy idea of starting a new newspaper just a couple of years before the communist Chinese were going to take over, explained to me why this made great business sense. And I listened. I still thought it was a little bit audacious, but 2 years later, he launched Apple Daily, and you know, that quickly became the most popular newspaper in Hong Kong with a very, very strong pro-democracy line. And 2 years after that, in 1997, the Chinese took over Hong Kong after 156 years of British colonial rule. And while every other publisher was backing off and trimming their sales, self-censoring, Jimmy and his team just plowed ahead with just gutsy, audacious reporting. It wasn't just all spinach, democracy, politics. It was crazy paparazzi culture. He had scores of photographers going around on motorcycles, beating the police and the fire department to the scenes of accidents or women giving birth on the street, as happened to a friend of mine's wife. And, you know, they were everywhere. They did horse racing. They did stock market stuff. They had Nobel Prize winning economists. You basically could write anything for Apple and Next, unless Jimmy saw it as kind of socialist. He was a radical free market kind of guy. Or, you know, later on, he definitely did not allow the newspaper to push any kind of pro-independence agenda for Hong Kong. But pretty freewheeling, wild, rock and rolling kind of place. I later joined the board of directors, and I was there when it was shut down by the government.
What was he like as a man, and what did he care about? This audacity that you speak of, where does that come from in your judgment?
Well, what was he like as a man? I mean, he's a larger than life guy in many ways. I mean, he's a bear of a man, you know, six foot one. You know, loud, booming voice, you know, never afraid to express his opinions. At the same time, a very shy man who Was happier spending time at home with a few friends. He was always inviting people over to his house. But at 9 o'clock or 9:30 at the latest, it was like, okay, goodbye. See you later. Thanks. And he'd, you know, go off and read and sleep. So, you know, very hospitable, but he wasn't on the party circuit. He wasn't interested in hobnobbing with the great and the good of Hong Kong or ingratiating himself with the communists or before that, the colonial authorities. And he also never wanted political leadership. I mean, he wasn't so he's in prison now, but he's not a Nelson Mandela type who's planning to come out and, you know, lead the country in a different direction. It's kind of a contradictory thing because, as I said, quite shy. And yet at the same time in public could appear, you know, almost bombastic. He's easily given to tears. One of the first times I saw him cry was back in June 1997 when he was on stage with the founder of USA Today, Al Newharth, and talked about his fears for Hong Kong and how he thought he'd go to jail. And he broke down in tears. He was right. You know, he got 20 plus years, but before he went to jail. But yeah, very emotional guy. His wife has said that he's got kind of the soul of a Russian poet or a Russian artist. And for anybody who's read Dostoevsky, the Brothers Karamazov, he's right out of those pages. And, you know, he's got this fiery, passionate temperament, and yet he has a deep spiritual contemplative side, which, you know, for better or worse, he's been able to develop in prison. He converted to Catholicism in 1997, immediately after the handover, and you know, he's a devout Catholic.
What would he write, or what would he allow to be written in the annals of his newspaper that others wouldn't dare to write? What do you know about that? What do you remember?
Well, first, I mean, just the investigative team. I mean, immediately or a year after the Tiananmen killings in June 1989, Next magazine started, and they immediately assembled the best investigative team that Hong Kong had ever seen. They hired good investigative reporters from particular TV stations, some other people, and they just went after people on everything, you know, money and corruption, of course. But you know, they'd take pictures of there's something of a prominent textile guy in particular, from a very prominent political family, and they followed him to the airport. They snapped pictures of him picking up his air hostess mistress, followed him to the hotel. Followed them in, watched him, you know, had the timer going, watched the guy coming out 30 or 45 minutes later. I mean, they would do, you know, this is really pretty salacious stuff. I mean, going after the, you know, the ruling powers. And they had never in Hong Kong history had they had that. It was a very cozy relationship between business, government, and the press. And of course, they always pushed for a pro-democracy agenda. So in late 2002, there was talk of a national security law coming in, and Hong Kong people were not surprisingly opposed to that. But most of them figured they couldn't do much about it. The communists were in charge. This is the kind of thing that happens. And if I remember correctly, it was October 2002 when a draft of this bill, or maybe a concept paper, a consultation paper came out, and there were, I don't know, a dozen or 20 people from the opposition that gathered around and had a symbolic protest and burned a copy of this consultation paper. So you think of that, a dozen or 20 people. On July 1st, the following year, so 8 months later, there were 500,000 people out in the streets protesting against that bill. So absent Jimmy Lai and Apple Daily and Next Magazine and at the peak, you know, 2,000 journalists who were working for the Hong Kong operations, journalists and other people, that would not have happened. Maybe you would have gotten, 5,000, yes, 50,000, maybe 500,000, no way. The only time there'd been anything like it in Hong Kong history was in support of the 1989 Tiananmen protesters. So this was something completely new. It was a domestic issue, and it was happening under Communist Party rule, under Beijing's rule. And I think Jimmy and I think the Chinese looked and they're like, wow, you've got a guy. The Chinese deliberately neutered and fractured the opposition, even though they would win the majority of votes in every election, the way things were were rigged in this very convoluted way. They could never actually take political power. All of a sudden, and they're very fractured. And all of a sudden, you have this guy, Jimmy Lives, coming out of this retail background. He's got this really bold, colorful newspaper, the first one to introduce color printing, incredible graphics, incredible photos. And you've got this guy, and he's getting 500,000 people out in the streets in a city of 7.5 million. By the way, they weren't coming over from mainland China. This is all Hong Kongers, close to 10% of the population. So, and it went on from there. But I think that was one of the key moments when Jimmy and his, you know, the guys on the other side, the guys up in Beijing said, wow, we've got somebody of a sort that we've never dealt with in the last 70, well, by now it's 75 years of communist Chinese rule.
Fascinating. The energy that this man had to have that level of dedication to a pro-democracy society, where does the anti-communism come from? How do you make sense of why such a, you know, larger than life character, but a shy man, as you mentioned, was able to commit himself to being the thorn in the side of one of the world's great superpowers? How do you make sense of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think it really goes to the heart of who Jimmy is. He was born in mainland China about 2 years before the communists took power in 1949, when Mao Zedong swept into Beijing, proclaimed the Chinese people have stood up. Jimmy was from southern China, just over the border from Hong Kong. It's a complicated family history, but his mother was the second wife who'd married into a rich shipping family. And the first wife died after the revolution. The father went off to Hong Kong, leaving the mother with Jimmy's twin sister. We think the father left when Jimmy was three or probably four. Excuse me. And there was a sister a couple years older. And it was so, okay, so the family is just shattered by the revolution. And his older half-siblings had gone to nice private schools in Guangzhou. The grandfather was reputed to have the first Rolls-Royce in the province, in Guangdong province, as I said, just across the border from Hong Kong. And but Jimmy grew up in, I mean, to say poverty, it kind of understates it. His mother was in and out of what Jimmy calls labor camps. I would caution people, they weren't like, you know, the kind of Xinjiang camp. She wasn't sent far away. She seemed to be able to come home on weekends, but it was some kind of punitive camp. She, even though she'd been a peasant, because she'd married into this rich family, she was guilty. She was a class enemy. Jimmy had to watch as his mother kneeled on broken glass and wore a dunce's cap and was jeered and humiliated by you know, people around her. And the family's house was split up. It had been a nice house, but, you know, all of a sudden other people moved in. So with the mother in and out of the labor camps, Jimmy, at the age of, I think this was probably about when he was 5 or 6 years old, but until he was 12, when he left for Hong Kong, he was a hustler. He never finished primary school. It was interesting. His twin sister had a phenomenal mind, and her brain was wired for school. She breezed through. You know, Jimmy just kind of couldn't sit still. He was hustling on the black market. He'd find half smoked cigarettes, put a couple of them together, re-roll it, and, you know, sell it as a new cigarette. He stole metal and sold it in the scrap metal market. And he was hungry. His mother would deliberately burn rice and bring it home for on the weekends when she came, so the kids would have a little to eat. And so you think of this, these kids, 4, 5, 6, 8 years old. The older sister, in fact, was a little bit developmentally challenged. So it was really Jimmy and his twin sister, CY, who were carrying the burden for this thing. And he was, you know, he was a troublemaker. And that's the title of my book, comes from Jimmy's description of himself. But he was, you know, he was well known to the cops, although they kind of liked him. He was this impish little urchin, I guess. But he was a porter at the Guangzhou railway station, and he met a guy from Hong Kong. The guy gave him a tip for carrying his luggage, and then as an afterthought, gave him a half-eaten bar of chocolate. And Jimmy kind of turned away. He was a little embarrassed to eat in front of the guy. He took a bite of this, and he was like, oh, wow, what is this? It's chocolate. And where are you from? Hong Kong. Wow, Hong Kong must be paradise if they've got chocolate there. I mean, for Jimmy at that time, you know, burned rice was pretty good. A grilled field mouse, if he could catch it, was like a delicacy. So he eventually convinced his mother to let him go to Hong Kong to leave. And he, through the help of a corrupt official that he befriended, he got a one-way permit to Macau, which was the Portuguese colony on the west side of the Pearl River Delta. It took me a long time. I mean, Jimmy's in prison, so I've known him for 30 years, but I didn't set out to, you know, write a biography of him. It wasn't like I spent years interviewing him. I've known him. I know him pretty well. But, you know, it took me a while. I never talked to him about these. He didn't talk much about these early days, but he's written about it in a series of weekly columns over the years. And it took me a while. Like, why would a mother let like a 12-year-old boy leave, especially in these kinds of circumstances? He's got to smuggle himself into Hong Kong. It's a dangerous sea crossing. You know, if the British Navy doesn't intercept you, you know, pirates could, the boat could, you know, sink. I mean, it's really desperate. And then I realized, well, it was a time, they called it the Great Leap Forward, spectacularly misnamed political campaign, because it was actually a time of the greatest man-made famine we've ever seen in the history of the world. Something like 45 million people died. And I think Jimmy's mother must have just been terrified that her only, you know, her only son was going to die. And so she gave him permission to go. And in fact, his older sister went a few years later. She actually swam across a short stretch. And Jimmy got to Macau and got himself on a smuggling boat and made the journey to Hong Kong. And he had the name of his mother's sister and address, went there. And this is a time when half of Hong Kong's population were people like Jimmy. I mean, there were shanty towns. People were sleeping on the streets. The aunt and uncle's hut was so tiny that there wasn't even room for Jimmy to sleep on the floor. So they found him a place that first night at a glove factory. And he slept on a table there. And he went from sleeping on a factory floor and being a teenage factory worker to 15 years later owning a factory, which, as I said before, quickly became the largest sweater maker in Hong Kong. So, you know, his hatred of the Chinese Communist Party is born from his experiences. But then you say, like, how did he channel that? How did he, because he's obviously more thoughtful than just blind hatred. Excuse me. And during his time in the garment trade, he spent a lot of time in New York. It was pretty much his second home. And one night at a dinner, his host, having listened to Jimmy fulminate against the Chinese communists, reached over his bookshelf and said, "Here, read this. It'll, you know, help you understand the bigger structure of what you're seeing." And it was Hayek's Road to Serfdom, which is, you know, it basically says, once that when the state plans the economy, it ends up basically planning and controlling people's lives. And Jimmy became a devoted reader of Hayek, Popper, a very good friend of Milton Friedman, the free market Nobel Prize winning economist. Sorry about that. And so that gave a broader theoretical framework to this kind of visceral hatred that he had for the communists, for, you know, wrecking what had been a kind of idyllic family existence for the, you know, before they took power.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Do you regard his foray into publishing, into the newspaper industry, as at least in part an attempt to act as an activist or as an arbiter of objective truth about the Communist Party and about China itself? Or was it more really about business? How do you come down on that?
Dan, that's a really great question. I think when he first went in, it was primarily as business. I mean, sure, he was really angry about the killings in Tiananmen when, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of Chinese were killed in Beijing and around the country. And, you know, he'd seen, I mean, we forget about this. Tiananmen was one of the first times we saw a dramatic, you know, a would-be revolution, I guess, happening in real time. CNN had just started in the early 1980s. And it was obviously way before the internet or anything. It was before the Berlin Wall fell. And so Jimmy saw this. He was totally captivated. He's very interested in technology, whether it's in garment making or retailing or media. And he said, wow, we've got some new technology. It's bringing transparency to the world. And under Deng Xiaoping, who succeeded Mao, the communists had started economic reforms. And Jimmy thought that the economic reforms would lead to political and social reforms. But he also thought that the media could really push things along. And he had both things in mind, but he was definitely doing it as a businessman. As a matter of fact, one of his earliest hires was it was a guy who Jimmy's pitch was, hey, look, we'll run this for a few years. And this was for the magazine, for Next Magazine. We'll run this for a few years and then we'll sell it. I mean, who wants to run a magazine? It's so much trouble. So the original idea was Jimmy as the businessman. And then I think, once he got into media, he was like, not bad. So when I met him in 1993, he was already well into planning, although he claimed that he was retired. He was really spending his time thinking about how to launch a newspaper, which is a whole different order of magnitude than running a weekly magazine. So, it developed organically, and he was a businessman till the end, till the media business ended. He, always had, big ambitions. We had 4,000 people in Taiwan and in Hong Kong at our peak. And I think other than the political roadblocks he ran up against in Hong Kong as well as in Taiwan, he would be thriving today. I mean, within 15 years of founding Next, by 2005, he'd built the most important independent Chinese language media in the world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's really something from a standing start, from a guy who's never been in media. So that answers your question.
Do you think that he regarded this obvious growing popularity of his newspaper and its messages? It's, as I understand it, it was the pro-democracy bent and exposing aspects of the government that didn't particularly make it look very good to the public, that he always regarded Hong Kong as, like a Russian poet or a Russian in general, eventually a tragic story? Or was he a man that believed that, as you said, technology, the truth, transparency could eventually overcome these forces that he seemingly dedicated his life to fight against?
You know, that's a really great question. Nobody's asked me that before. Let me try. probably both at the same time. I mean, he was, on the one hand, he's crying on the stage in 1997, thinking he's going to go to jail. And on the other hand, he kept thinking for many years after that more trade, more economic development, more economic liberalization would eventually bring change to China. It would mean consigning the Chinese Communist Party to the dustbin of history. I mean, that's really how he thought. Interestingly, in 2000, when the first democratic transition took place in Taiwan and the opposition won the presidency for the first time, the night that Chen Shui-bian was elected, who was the opposition leader, Jimmy said to his wife, "We're moving to Taiwan." And he moved to Taiwan. He brought his family there. Sorry about that. He started first Next Magazine and then Apple Daily, just as he had done in Hong Kong. And when you read the annual reports, this is a publicly traded company by this point. It's very interesting. Jimmy is really clear that Taiwan is going to be his springboard into the mainland. They speak the same languages on the mainland, unlike the Cantonese in Hong Kong. They're just a lot of cross-border or cross-strait links. And for several years, Jimmy was just writing about how the closer links were going to lead to political change in China, and that Apple, again, this was going to be the springboard into the mainland. So he I think he had both views at once. Usually, when we would talk over dinner, he was predicting the fairly imminent collapse of the Chinese Communist Party. Obviously, he was a little premature about that.
Yeah. I'd love to bring the conversation up to closer to the present moment and go into whatever phase of the last few years you think really matter about what has brought us to his circumstances today. And you can take that however you would like, but in to a general lay audience that's just getting familiar with his story, how do you describe, how do you explain his eventual conviction, his eventual move into prison, him being persecuted? I know there's a lot there, but maybe if we could focus on the, in your mind, the most important moments from the last number of years that has led this man to be a man, I know you write in your book, who has homes all over the world, who could have escaped Hong Kong really whenever he wanted and was well aware of the fact that he was in danger, how he is now in jail, I think maybe even solitary confinement. What is that story?
Yeah. So 2003, we mentioned where he, you know, 500,000 people come out in the streets. And by the way, I didn't mention they're carrying posters and pull out from Next Magazine, the newspaper, things that were designed to be carried in the poster, made into protest signs. And then he spent much of that decade, as I said, in Taiwan. And he ran into some real roadblocks there, mostly from the business community. He was trying to get into broadcast. He was really pushing the envelope technologically. He started an animation studio. So he kind of was out of Hong Kong a little bit. And then in 2012, there was an important student-led movement. And in 2014, a more important student-led movement that saw protesters occupy the center of Hong Kong for 79 days, actually several different areas. And it's interesting, Jimmy wanted to support the students. And so for the first time, he was on the front lines. He was tear gassed. He was out there for 79 days, camping or sitting during the day in front of his tents, not trying to make a big deal of himself. He was just an ordinary guy sitting there, but really showing his solidarity with the students. And at the end, he was arrested on civil disobedience charges, not prosecuted. So that kind of pulled him into things more. And Hong Kong was kind of simmering with tension for the next several years. And in 2019, Jimmy and Apple and Next led an extraordinary public campaign against, sounds kind of technical, but it was a bill to make it easy to send Hong Kongers to the mainland for court cases. You know, not something that anybody in Hong Kong wanted, knowing, you know, what we know about mainland Chinese justice. So it wasn't just 500,000 people out in the streets. It was 2 million some days. It's like proportionately, it would be as if 90 million people marched on Washington. I mean, it's incredible numbers. You couldn't even move through the streets. And at the end of that year, the Democrats, the pan-Democrats, really, it was several different parties, won an overwhelming, a landslide victory in some district council, very, very low-level political jobs that, you know, really had very little power. I think this totally freaked out Beijing. They saw this this violence, this uprising, arguably was the most sustained challenge to Chinese communist rule since 1949, even more than the Tiananmen Spring. And I think they just said, we have to destroy it. And they came in with and Jimmy Lai is public enemy number one. He's the black hand. He's the puppet master. It's him that's driving all this. So they came in with a really broad, sweeping, vague national security law in mid 2020. And Jimmy was first arrested under that. About 6 weeks later, they raided. They came to his house and handcuffed him and perp walked him through took him down to the newsroom. There were 250 cops there, just tearing apart our newspaper. A couple months later, they let him out on bail. But a couple months later, they put him in jail for good, really. I mean, it's been more than 1,500 days, mostly in solitary confinement. There, he's been convicted of a number of minor kind of made up charges. But it's the big one right now. He's in there for a national security law charge that he will certainly be convicted. And it's a minimum 10 years in prison, could be life. He's 77 years old. Even 10 years is pretty much like a life imprisonment at this point. So that's kind of, yeah, where he is right now. I should just say these charges are a sham. I mean, they'd be a joke if it weren't so serious, if somebody's life weren't at stake. I mean, they consist of basically running a newspaper and speaking out for democracy in Hong Kong. And I don't know what to say, except that it's a reflection of how far Hong Kong has fallen, that a place that used to have rule of law, you know, honest, transparent government that was guaranteed, the Chinese, when they took it over, guaranteed that for 50 years, Hong Kong could have all of its existing freedoms, freedom of press, speech, religion. It would have its own currency, its own tax system. It would essentially be an autonomous state, you know, without an army or foreign policy or anything, but it could just keep going as it had always done. And it turns out that that promise proved impossible for Beijing to keep. So I think there are, you know, maybe a couple of lessons we should be thinking about here. One is, can we trust Beijing for any of the promises it makes? I mean, its promises were made in an international treaty signed with Britain, lodged at the United Nations, which China just tore up. 20 years after the handover, it just said, sorry, that's null and void. There were similar promises made in the Basic Law, which is the kind of mini constitution that governs Hong Kong. Again, just completely disregarded. So, you know, that's number one. Number two is, how do you run a global financial center, which is what Hong Kong wants to think that it is, when you've got political prisoners? It's not only Jimmy. I have six other colleagues in jail. They've all pled guilty. They haven't been sentenced. They're basically being held hostage for the end of Jimmy's trial. And it'll be 5 years since his arrest this August. And, you know, there's no sign really when the trial is going to end. Maybe he'll be sentenced at the end of this year. We're supposed to have closing arguments in August. So, you know, what does this say about Hong Kong? You've got almost 1,000, besides my colleagues, almost 1,000 political prisoners in Hong Kong. So I think the lesson is that Jimmy Lai is somebody of the sort that the Chinese communists have not seen in their 75 years of rule. So he's a number one. Any one of these three factors would make him a dangerous person in the communists' eyes. Number one, he's a businessman. So he's got resources. He has international connections. He's got money to hire great lawyers. Number two, he was a media guy. He was a giant. So he had a megaphone. And we all know that the Chinese think of that media should be propaganda. And number three, he has principles. And this may be the hardest for the Chinese to deal with, because they basically kind of run like the mafia. They care about power and staying in power and money and taking care of their family above all. And he's got principles that are beyond that. As you said, he could have left. He's a British citizen. He hasn't had Chinese citizenship since he left in 1961. And he could have left, but he decided to stay because he believes in Hong Kong and he wanted to shine a spotlight on what's happening in a place that was where I lived there 28 years. We were promised rule of law. We were promised freedom. And those promises are being shattered. So the combination of a guy with wealth, a guy with a media megaphone, and somebody with principles who, of course, wants to be out of prison, but is willing to die in prison if he has to, I think makes this a real conundrum for the Chinese. And I don't think they quite know where to go from here.
I'd love to focus a little bit on that last point of the principles, because you just said it. I was going to say it in my follow-up, which is that it seems like he has already reconciled himself to the fact that he may die for this, and that this is worthy of his commitment in that way. And that is incredibly rare in this world, especially among people of the level of status and wealth that can get out of situations like that with their own power. When you think about the principles that Jimmy Lai holds specific to this issue, to resistance, what are those principles in your mind? What is it? You mentioned earlier that he's Catholic. You mentioned earlier that he lived and has seen the horrors of what a communist system can inflict upon normal individual people. How do you make sense of that? What are the guiding principles of this man that make him do things that are extraordinarily rare. And I think in anyone who comes across these stories, just something that is just deeply moving and inspiring.
Yeah, and very, very humbling. And as somebody who's known him, you know, as a father, as a husband, you know, just as a family guy, a normal guy, like, you know, takes you out on his boat, invites you to dinner. I mean, it's unbelievable to me, honestly. But I've in the course of writing this biography, I understood, you know, a lot more than I had known about him in the first, you know, 28 years or something that I'd known him. And I mean, part of it is this, this background of coming out of just incredible privation that I talked about before. I mean, there's the it's something of a cliche, but the Nietzsche's quote that, you know, what doesn't destroy me makes me stronger. Now, let's not forget that for every Jimmy Lai, there were thousands of people who were destroyed. I mean, he really is literally one in a billion. There's no businessman. There are a handful of business people who've stood up a bit over the last 75 years. You know, they've pretty much been crushed. And there is one guy who's in jail right now in the mainland. I think he got a 12-year sentence because he called Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, a clown. So, you know, there are one or two people, but not many people. And obviously, there's some very, very brave dissidents and human rights defenders in China, but they didn't quite have the choices. I mean, Jimmy, as you said, you know, he saw this coming for 20 years, more than 20 years, and he stayed. So I think the fact that he survived this incredible childhood and went from, you know, could have died of famine, came to Hong Kong, became unbelievably wealthy. I mean, he's a brilliant entrepreneur, and I hadn't appreciated that enough, even though I'd known him for years before I started working on this book. I talked to people who've known him since the 70s, and he's just an extraordinary guy. But so it's this combination of unbelievable self-confidence and somehow a total lack of fear. I've worked with a lot of business people. I ran a group called the Asia Business Council in Hong Kong for many years. Fantastic people, very successful, creme de la creme of Asian business. None of them would stand up in a political situation like this. I mean, business, you know, we don't. We can see this today around the world. I mean, when a state trains its forces on you, it's really scary. And I was, you know, it's a very small thing, but, you know, as a director of the company, of Jimmy's media company, Next Digital, I was caught up in some of the fallout. And, you know, we had, I don't know, four different state-led investigations against us. And it's scary. I'm not in Hong Kong anymore. Jimmy is, right? So somehow this idea of this incredible self-confidence, self-reliance, belief in himself, coupled with this unshakable belief in what's right. And he had this even before he converted to Catholicism and in 1997. So when I first met him in 93, I mean, he was already, he's pretty much the same Jimmy that I know, you know, until he went into jail. In 1994, he wrote a really savage attack on the then premier of China, Li Peng, known as the Butcher of Beijing. And when the Chinese shut down his retail stores, he went off the board and sold his shares in the company. Like, what other businessman would sell shares in a really money spinning company to focus on this little fledgling media company? So this belief in what's right. And so it's been deepened by his Catholicism, but it was always there. So this unshakable faith in himself, this deep belief in what's right, with now, you know, I think underpinned and strengthened by his Catholic faith, gives him a force that's almost superhuman. I mean, he's not, he's a man, he's a person, but it's a really unique combination. Very, very powerful. I should just say that he's not your typical human rights activist. He talks in the language of often Western values, sometimes universal values. Actually, the judges do not like this, because they say there aren't universal values. We've got Chinese values and you've got your Western values. He talks about rule of law all the time. And he talks about the desire and the need to defend Hong Kong's freedoms. He says, quite rightly, this is a place that gave me everything. I mean, you know, it gave him food when he was hungry. It gave him the ability to work, to start his own business, you know, to have a political platform, eventually to find, you know, the love of his life, his wife, Teresa, and his Catholic faith. And so it's a pretty formidable combination.
It seems like he clearly has the life experience of living in those two systems and is able to compare them quite clearly. I wonder if for people that come across this in our country or in the West in general or other countries in the world, it is not particularly fashionable anymore to speak about good and bad in that clear of a delineation, in those clear of terms. And I wonder in your, you know, research for the book and writing the book, what you think a reasonable Westerner can or should take away from his example in terms of clarifying the opposition in terms of, I don't know if you think this way, in terms of the U.S. or the West versus China or the Western countries versus totalitarianism. I'd just like to put that to you of what you think are reasonable lessons from his example that we would be well positioned and it would behoove us to take in and take seriously because of his life, because of what he has stood for.
Yeah, interesting question. I think, don't be naive and study Chinese history, and especially look at the history of the Chinese Communist Party, and don't go in blindly. I mean, there's this so much temptation to get psyched out by the so-called 5,000 years of Chinese history. And this culture that supposedly values, you know, face and you know, certain ways of doing things. It's not nonsense. I mean, don't check your values at the door. Mm-hmm. If you're a company, you know, of course, now they've finally belatedly gotten the message, like because of perhaps of Volkswagen's, unfortunate lesson in Xinjiang. You don't go into a place where there's slave labor and you know, prisons, the largest roundup of civilians since the Nazi period. You don't go in there and build your factory more or less next door. I mean, I know it's tough for business people, but they need to be clear-eyed. And so whether it's business or diplomats, there were a lot of well-meaning people in the Biden administration, but I mean, I think on the whole, they were just, you know, they're too soft, too easy on China. I just can't believe that we're shutting down Radio Free Asia, Voice of America, these incredible beacons of soft power that help exemplify, you know, what's best about our country and what's best about many of our values, including openness, a willingness to listen to criticism, to look at all sides of an issue. But I would also say that, you know, just more broadly and not just dealing with Beijing, one person can really make a difference. I mean, that's really the lesson from Jimmy. And it's also a lesson, sadly, from Hong Kong, where we have a handful of judges. They're from a secret panel of national security law judges who are willing to do the government's bidding. And they're destroying the rule of law there. And it's pretty easy with a small number of people and a defiance of past norms to wreck a free system. These are very, very fragile, and they depend on accepted norms and not busting those norms and essentially trashing the checks and balances that exist to prevent people who want power from wrecking other people's lives. And again, I was on the other end of it in the smallest way in Hong Kong. It's really scary when the state comes after you. You don't want to allow the state to just easily come after you. And I was never, I don't think, in any danger of jail. But even the hassle and expense and just psychic strain of having to, you know, prepare, deal with investigators and hire lawyers and things is really tough.
A couple more things I want to go over before we close this down. When you look at Jimmy's situation and you look at Hong Kong in general, what is your prediction about how this unfurls over the next 5-10 years? Are you resigned to the fact that Jimmy is going to die in prison, and that Hong Kong is essentially a lost cause for, you know, democracy and the freedoms that, you know, I assume you hold dear and cherish, that they're slowly or quickly losing? What is your best guess as to where this is all heading?
Okay. I have a PhD in history, and that allows me to say I do not predict the future.
Yeah.
I think many of us who work on Hong Kong human rights are convinced. I would say we've become increasingly optimistic in the last 6 months or so that that Jimmy will be released from prison in time, I hope, time to enjoy life with his family outside of Hong Kong. So I certainly don't think Jimmy is a lost cause. I think as far as Hong Kong goes, it's an interesting dilemma that the Chinese Communist Party faces. And by the way, I'm assuming, I mean, look, anything can happen with China. I don't want to say it's unstable, but they have lasted longer than any other communist state. And I often get the sense that the leadership is kind of riding a tiger, right? And they keep trying to crack down more and more. And yet there are still people who, you know, have different ideas. You take during COVID, people got so fed up with basically being treated like prisoners that a few hundred of them just holding up blank pieces of paper prompted the government overnight to completely change its COVID strategy. So strange things can happen in China, but let's assume that we have the status quo for another 5 or 10 years. I would hope that Chinese authorities realize that, particularly with their economy doing so badly, more or less flatlining, despite this talk of 5% growth, that they would understand that Hong Kong plays an important role as a global financial center. And again, global financial centers do not have 1,000 political prisoners. Actually, they usually really don't have any. And I would hope that they would ease off, that they'd see that there's an off ramp. There are sanctions on Hong Kong officials. There are likely to be more sanctions on Hong Kong officials, particularly judges and prosecutors, which foreign governments, including the U.S., don't like to do because we don't like to interfere with other countries' legal systems. But we can now see this is a corrupt legal system. And so I think they've got a choice. There's going to be, you know, life is going to become more and more difficult for the Quislings that are, you know, wrecking Hong Kong, or there's a path of easing, whether it's sanctions being, being eased or some of the other measures that have been taken against Hong Kong, travel advisory, business warning being eased. I think that's up to Beijing to decide. I actually think that the Hong Kong leadership got themselves and Beijing in a bit of a pickle. I think they were told to kind of take care of the situation, take care of Jimmy. And instead, they have a trial that's, as I say, it's coming up to 5 years, 5 years since his initial arrest. They can't bring the trial to an end. The thing is a joke. There's lots of smoke, absolutely no fire in terms of having done anything other than speaking out for democracy, using his constitutionally guaranteed rights of free speech and freedom of media. So I think that Beijing could step in and, we've got it won't be until about another 2 years. We've got a new chief executive, a new mayor will be coming in Hong Kong. Sorry, they could choose the same hardline guy who's just running the place into the ground, who's a ex-cop who's never had any political experience. Or they could choose somebody a little bit softer. So, you know, I'm not saying that Hong Kong is going to go back to its freewheeling old days, but, you know, there is a path to a little bit softer, gentler Hong Kong that does become a little bit more integrated or reintegrated with the rest of the world. That's really up to Beijing to decide. It's not the guys in Hong Kong who are deciding it. And I have to make this point, roughly 6 out of 10 people in Hong Kong always voted for the pro-democracy candidates from the first elections under the British in 1991 until those district council elections I mentioned in the end of 2019. So you have always had a substantial majority of people voting for democracy. Now, look, hundreds of thousands of people have left Hong Kong. Those are definitely for almost all pro-democracy people. But, you know, still there's a very substantial percentage of Hong Kongers who value freedom and democracy. And, you know, I think they're biding their time. But of course, they would like a freer, more open Hong Kong. And, you know, look, Apple Daily's not going to be running again. You're not going to have 2 million people out in the streets. But you could have an e-zine. And that's the best option for Hong Kong, for China, really for the world.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Would love to close with this. I think it was Orwell who once said, either no biography or autobiography should be trusted if it does not reveal something disgraceful about its subject. And you said this earlier that, you know, Jimmy is not a, you know, superhuman. He's one of us. And I wonder if we could close with the observations of you, of his foibles, of his humanity, of his eccentricities. It's very easy to paint this person, like an Alexei Navalny, as they're unbelievably admirable and courageous in what they do, but they're still human. I think that's actually helpful for people to remember that they have problems that we can all relate to. They have overcome things that are difficult. They've had to face a lot of fear. I don't know if anything comes to mind about Jimmy specifically, but I wonder if it might be helpful to close with some of his flaws, some of his oddities, some of his mistakes that he's made, anything that comes to mind that could add some humanity to this remarkable man.
Yeah, well, I think Jimmy would be the first one to admit that he's, you know, in his language, he'd say he's a sinner. I mean, he's done lots of things that he's not proud of. I mean, back in the 70s when he was going to New York a lot, I mean, and when buyers, textile people were coming out to Hong Kong, you know, wine, whiskey, women, weed, you know, you wanted it. Jimmy's the guy. Jimmy was the party guy. And I don't think he's made any, you know, any secret of that. I mean, he led a libertine kind of existence. He had a pet bear in his backyard. I mean, he had a whole menagerie of things. Yeah, he ran a pretty open, crazy kind of house, you know, jacuzzi, people smoke, and people did not smoke weed in Hong Kong in the 80s, but they did at Jimmy's, you know, kind of wandering in and out of the jacuzzi and, you know, looking out at the hills of Kowloon, some clothes, some not, you know, he had pretty young kids at the time, you know, just preteens. He definitely had a different lifestyle. I mentioned Teresa, who he met in 1989, a couple of years after his wife left him. I think that, you know, he went from kind of libertine existence to one that had much more purposeful existence. It's hard to speculate, but he could have been like many entrepreneurs and kind of, you know, been rich, had his Rolls Royce and his pet bear and things, but not, you know, not had this kind of core that he ended up discovering in himself. Maybe it was always there, but I think Teresa really helped build it out. But even then, when he was baptized, you know, and became a Catholic, converted in 1997, his godfather, Bill McGurn from the Wall Street Journal, remembers thinking, yeah, this is great. I'm sure he really believes this. But, you know, meanwhile, his newspaper is running reviews of bordellos, you know, and worse, by the way. I mean, prostitution was legal in Hong Kong. So I guess running restaurant reviews of, so to speak, of prostitution, you know, wasn't like it was illegal, but it was certainly like at the edge of good taste and arguably beyond. They had worse coverage. I mean, I think the most horrible thing that the newspaper did, and it was under Jimmy's watch, was this unbelievably tragic story of a mother who committed suicide along with two of her kids. Apple Daily then gave him gave the widower cash to go across the border to Shenzhen into China and go on this, you know, completely orgiastic, you know, spending spree with his mistress and chronicled the whole thing. So Jimmy apologized, but I mean, honestly, you know, there's a almost a recklessness to him that's, I mean, it's very, very noble that it's been transformed, you know, for the cause of freedom. But I think in some cases was not so positive.
Absolutely fascinating, Mark. I love this conversation. And I think his example and the information in your book and the subject in general is just so important. Really an honor to do this. Thanks for coming on.
Well, Dan, thanks for your interest. It's been fun. Really enjoyed the questions, and stay in touch.
Sounds good.